Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week I am delighted to present to you once again, Mike T. Nelson. At the 2019 Ancestral Health Symposium, I managed to catch up with metabolism and fitness expert Mike T. Nelson. Mike was there presenting on a subject that many in the health space find both intriguing and confusing: cannabinoids and CBD. Really, who amongst us hasn't wondered if using CBD will get us into hot water at the next work-related drug screening? And is it even legal? In this podcast, Mike demystifies the terms bantered about when it comes to the cannabis plant. What exactly is the difference between hemp, THC, and CBD anyway? He cuts through the marketing hype and talks about the specific health conditions that respond best to cannabidiol. He also shares exactly how he uses it to prevent brain injury during extreme sports. Just before we get into this week's interview with Dr. Mike T. Nelson, as you listen, try keeping in mind the four quadrant model that Dr. Josh Turknet presented a couple of episodes back. Look in your podcast app for the episode titled How to Win at Angry Birds. As you hear a potential therapeutic intervention discussed in this episode, ask yourself, what quadrant does this belong? Is it a source code or a game level intervention? Does it minimize environmental mismatch or is it disruptive? Once you categorize the interventions, then you'll know what's more important and what to do first. Last week, Drs. Kirk Parsley and Greg Potter talked about sleep. Some of the therapeutics discussed were clearly quadrant four. For example, PharmaGABA and 5-HTP. Supplemental magnesium is a source code level intervention, but also supportive and therefore belongs in quadrant three. Starting school later reduces an environmental mismatch and belongs in quadrant one. Reducing environmental mismatch is always where we start when working with clients at MBT. Now, over to the interview with Dr. Mike T. Nelson. Well, Dr. Mike T. Nelson, thank you for joining me here at the Ancestral Health Symposium San Diego. I was very excited to see your talk yesterday on cannabis. You're going to have to start with some definitions. First of all, though, before we get into that, I'm really interested to know how you chose this topic. You know, I wondered if you were starting to be pigeonholed a little bit as that metabolic flexibility guy. Did you get bored about talking about metabolic flexibility?
No, what happened was about 3.5 years ago, I started looking at research. If I get dropped out of the sky kiteboarding on my head, have a TBI or some type of brain trauma, is there something I should be doing ahead of time?
Right.
And my thoughts were, fish oil, maybe some loading on creatine, and there's some good studies on that. And as I'm looking at it, these things called cannabinoids and CBD kept showing up in the research. And at the time, I was like, I don't know. I didn't know anything about it. I, grew up and thought, oh, that's just cannabis. That's going to make you, one with your couch cushion. You're getting nothing done. Your life's going to go to hell. And I remember having a flashback to, I talked to Peter Rouse, who used to be out here in California. I think he's in New Zealand now, many years ago. And he was telling me about CBD. He was like the first guy I heard about it. And I'm like, oh, isn't that from cannabis? He's like, yeah, but it's not, psychoactive. And this is maybe like 10 years ago or something.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, what? And I just kind of filed it away as, that's something kind of odd. And so I was looking at the research. It kept popping up again and again. And I initially started writing, I guess you could say, sort of a semi-technical paper on traumatic brain injury and the impact of nutrition, which that ended up sort of morphing to the effect of cannabinoids and traumatic brain injury. And then about as of last year, I was like, what should I do for topics for presentations? So I did sort of a informal poll and everyone's like, oh yeah, CBD, you should go talk about
really?
CBD. And I'm like,
it's a sexy new thing.
Yeah. And at that time, this is a year and a half ago, I just kind of poked my head up from the research and did just a, Google search on CBD. And I'm like, holy crap, this is like everywhere. And like now, 2 months ago, it's even more everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 2 years ago, also, the guys who run Charlotte's Web, a buddy of mine does distribution for them through Driven Nutrition.
Oh, what's Charlotte's Web? I have no idea what that
so
is.
So Charlotte's Web is probably one of the original people who did CBD. They do medical marijuana.
I think of the story, the children's story.
Exactly.
Very
that's
moving.
What it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's sort of kind of named after that. So they're in Colorado. And I had heard a little bit about him. And it turns out I was there presenting a neuro conference, and it was the same weekend. So my buddy's like, yeah, it's like another one of our employees is going to be out there. He's like, you know, I can, you know, hook you up if you want to hang out with them for a weekend. I'm like, sure. So, you know, signed an NDA, got a tour of the, you know, facility, got a tour of everything around there. And I was like, huh, there actually is more to this. There are, you know, some companies appearing to do it in a correct and, you know, beneficial way and taking it very seriously. I've been doing it for many years.
Hmm. And did they show you a certificate of analysis? That was one concern I had. I saw these FDA notices, or maybe they were FTC, I can't remember which, and they tested a bunch of products and they found no active anything in there. It's just a bunch of olive oil. It's just a bunch of carrier oil.
Yeah, there's, even going back 3 years now, there's three or four reported studies of inadequate amounts of CBD, high amounts of THC. So by definition, CBD oil to sell as a supplement has to be under 0.3% THC.
I was going to say, this is probably a good time to do some introductions, because there's all these words and I don't really understand what they all mean, you know, like cannabis versus marijuana versus CBD versus THC. What are all these things?
Well, that's when I started looking at CBD, I realized, oh, well, I try to go all the way back to what are the first principles, right? So I'm like, okay, CBD comes from the cannabis or also the hemp plant. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, what's the difference between hemp? What's the difference between cannabis? What's the difference between marijuana? Mm. So if you go all the way back, you know, cannabis has been used for literally thousands of years. There was a study showing 2,700 years ago, I think it was in India or China, they dug up some burial and found like a stash of, you know, cannabis that appeared to had already even been crossbred at that time. Mm. So if you go back in time, it's been around kind of for a long, long period of time. The hard part with research in the US is that it's considered a scheduled one drug. Mm. So a scheduled one drug means there's a super high potential for addiction and there's absolutely no medical use for it, which cannabis doesn't really fit in that category at all. Mm-hmm. Like even in 1994, Marinol, which is a form of THC, was approved as a pharmaceutical. So even during this time, the FDA says, hey, here's a pharmaceutical we approved that's basically from cannabis. Mm-hmm. Ooh, but cannabis is a scheduled one. Cocaine is a scheduled two, meaning that there's a pretty high addiction potential, but there's a medical use for it.
Right.
Which is, as you may guess, numbing the nose during a surgical procedure, which is
not strange. Why didn't they change it then? So once the drug was approved, why was cannabis not changed to a Schedule II?
Oh, that gets into a lot of political stuff back in the 50s and 60s with Nixon kind of sort of threw it in with, you know, a lot of the other drugs, you know, psilocybin, LSD, those are all kind of reclassified around that time too.
Okay.
And the whole Reefer Madness campaign, which was pretty much all fiction. And there wasn't really any good research or medical reason for its rescheduling.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, if you make something a Schedule One, makes it highly illegal. And the amount of paperwork to do research on a Scheduled One drug is just astronomical.
I see.
So there wasn't a lot of U.S. research on it. So some of the research now is still from OUS sources.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at, okay, what is the difference between cannabis and hemp? Can we genetically kind of disassociate them? And there's studies to show that you can. The main definition that's used now, according to the U.S. law, it's considered hemp if it's under 0.3% THC.
Okay.
And that was via the farm bill.
Right.
So when that happened, which it got changed relatively recently, that it is hemp, if you can say this is hemp, it is regulated under the Department of Agriculture.
Oh, interesting.
So if you're a supplement company, you can now obtain hemp if it's low enough THC. It's regulated under the Department of Agriculture, so not the DEA, not the FDA. You're still subject to all the FDA for making it as a supplement, but that does mean that it is not a legal Scheduled One compound.
Okay.
And that sort of kind of opened up the floodgates to manufacturing a lot more CBD with less legal risk because of how it's differentiated at the government level.
Right.
Which also means that CBD is legal in all 50 states, can be sold as a over-the-counter supplement.
Okay.
Obviously, cannabis, if you have a high amount of THC, even above that, so it's not classified as hemp, then it's classified as basically, you know, cannabis or marijuana, which then is subject to
state laws.
Can
you use those two
laws.
Words interchangeably?
Kind of. Marijuana is more of a slang term, actually.
Okay.
It's actually the cannabis plant. And right. then within that, so if you go to your local dispensary, they're like, oh, we have a sativa this, and we have a indica this, and we've got a hybrid now. And what that was from was there's actually another compound called ruderalis, which is primarily a cannabis plant that's higher in fiber, which kind of is considered sort of hemp. In the strain name, it turns out, that's probably all pretty much BS too.
Okay.
Because if you said, okay, hey, I got this new strain and I want to determine what it is, cool, I got all the fancy lab equipment. All right, I'll do a HPLC or whatever method I'm going to look at. Okay, but I need a known 100% compound to compare it to, right?
Right.
Otherwise, I don't know what percentage sativa this is. And it turns out those 100% known compounds just don't exist. Because the plants have been so crossbred that there's nothing to really compare that to.
Right.
And the folklore of where I came from was a sativa, the plant itself has a different leaf shape, tends to grow very high and a little bit more spread out.
Right.
So the theory is that because of the structure of the plant, that is very uplifting and makes you feel better and gives you more energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that the indica is more of this kind of shorter, kind of shrubby looking plant. And then it's, you know, closer to the ground, man. It kind of, you know, sort of chills you out. And if you look in the research, the first time that sativa was used, as far as I can tell, was 1542.
Wow.
And it was translation meant a cultivated cannabis.
Okay.
When people were trying to cultivate it. And the main guy on that was actually, his name is Fux. F-U-C-H-S.
We will, of course, link to this spelling in the show notes.
Yeah. And then indica was about 200 years later after that.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, like I said, if you go into stores and they have a hybrid, which is a mixing of the two, there's a genetic studies that have been done on that. It's very hard to differentiate the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So now what they're trying to get is there's different what they call sort of fact sheets that'll say, hey, here's where we think this name of the strain is. Here's where we think the sourcing is. But then they'll do a chemical analysis of all the compounds in it.
That's amazing.
So how much THC, how much CBD, how much of all these other possible cannabinoids that they can look for. They're usually not on the sheet right now. But then they also have all these other compounds like terpenes.
Right.
So terpenes are in all sorts of different fruits, vegetables, and they account for kind of the distinct smells.
Mm.
So if you smell cannabis, some of it smells like diesel fuel. Some of it smells like lemons.
But where those I am, it always terpenes. Smells like skunk. Like sometimes it's indistinguishable yes. between a skunk.
Right.
I mean, we have these stinky skunks where I live, and a lot of people that smoke
in
weed.
California,
in,
so, yeah, like,
exactly. In fact, actually, there was a vacant lot right next to ours. And there was a big fire in 2008 in Bonnie Doon, and they evacuated everyone. And there was a lot of police and all kinds of other services in and around. And the vacant lot, they were growing weed on it. and they got busted. And I'm not sure. I think it was just like the number. It's legal if you have a license, but maybe it was like not like, you know, the plant itself is illegal. It's just that you didn't play by all the rules in order to grow it. You know, I think that's why they got busted.
Yeah, they've changed the rules. And I don't know what the exact rule in California is, but there's most states have a limit on the number of plants you can grow for personal use.
Right, right.
And once obviously you get above that, they consider you're doing distribution and you need a license. And all that kind of stuff.
Obviously, it makes a lot of sense from a business perspective to have something that's unique, right? Like, you can only get this from me. Like, we see this with supplements as well.
Yeah.
Like, if you can come up with some crazy blend of amino acids or something else, and then you give it a special label and you can only get it from me, then I'm not just going to find out about it on some podcast and then go buy the generic whatever from Amazon.com.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what drives people to create these special strains, even though they're basically meaningless, right?
Yeah, the strain name doesn't mean a whole lot because you can take the same strain name from different locations and get different chemical analyses.
Okay.
Maybe at best it gets you in the ballpark.
Right.
The newer, like Amsterdam has kind of gone away from using those names almost altogether, or they're trying to.
And what do they use instead?
They're trying to, that's the thing. No one is entirely sure because at one level from a consumer standpoint, having one name associated with one feeling is really, really good for marketing.
Right.
Right. So if you come in and you're like, hey, I want something that's going to really, you know, help me sleep at night. You know, they're going to be like, oh, you need an indica.
Right.
Right. And versus, oh, well, let's break out the fact sheet on each one and look for this or that compound. It unfortunately adds a lot more complexity to the simple story. And then we're not even 100% sure what all the terpene compounds do completely in isolation, much less all mixed together.
Right.
So,
well, that was going to be one of my questions. Do you think it's even possible or useful to try and like associate the different applications or effects or indications to specific isolated plant compounds? Or is it some heterogeneous effect of the cannabis plant? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, so there's a thing they call the entourage effect.
Okay.
Which means that it's a synergistic combination of all these different compounds actually in the plant itself. And there is good data to support that. So if you look at even standardized for CBD and sort of with mixed cannabinoids or in different formats versus just 100% pure isolated CBD or even THC, when you have the other plant compounds in controlled studies, you can get by with less of the active compound, which would support the notion that there is kind of a synergistic effect going on. Mm. Those studies have started in like the late 90s.
Okay.
But there is some data to support that kind of entourage type effect, which anyone talks about synergy, I always get a little nervous.
I know.
Real
it's kind
synergy
of woo,
is
isn't it?
Very rare.
Yeah.
Right, the supplement world has done a horrible job with that. You know, of like, bro, just take more of your creatine and then you take your beta alanine.
I knew you
and
were gonna
then you
say
have
that.
A synergistic effect between them. It's like, at best, you may have an additive effect. But
it makes more sense when they're in the same plant, right? It's like humans do tend to try and reduce things down to their component parts. And
always.
And don't always understand what they're doing in doing so.
Yeah. But, so I think the future will be more of a fact sheet. And they do have a little area on there now that kind of says what are the expected effects from it.
That fact sheet that you showed in your talk, and I will, of course, link to your AHS talk in the show notes, was quite extraordinary. Like the level of sophistication in that fact sheet was quite amazing.
Yeah. And the nice part then is that that allows you to do more of a direct comparison.
Right.
So in the future, we have more data to say, okay, these are probably, you know, these 1, 2, 3 compounds, you know, are 80% of the effect or whatever it is. If your, you know, favorite weed guy doesn't make whatever anymore and you had the fact sheet on it, you could then maybe compare it to something else and have an idea of, you know, where to transition and to where to start again.
I'm just thinking about a recommender system. If you like that, then you'll probably like this, you know, like you've just basically given me the attributes.
I'm sure somebody's working on that.
I'm sure someone is. So tell me about the indications or the application. So you mentioned traumatic brain injury. Do you think there's anything there?
I think so. I mean, the data is still a little bit preliminary. So one of the studies that was done was a retrospective study looking at THC content, because at the time the study was done, THC was illegal. So you can't really do a prospective trial of, hey, we're going to dose these people with THC. These people, we are not.
We're going to do something illegal.
Yeah. Right. You could, but I mean, the amount of paperwork and stuff to do it is very hard.
Right.
So they did a retrospective analysis, I think, of 447 people, and they looked at a tox screen and people who were positive for THC and people who weren't. So they're just showing, did you have THC present or did you not? And the group that had THC present, they followed them up for, I want to say it was like 10 or 11 years. It's quite a while. That their mortality, so a hard endpoint, were you dead or were you not, right? Which from a statistic standpoint is easy to determine. Sounds kind of cruel.
Right. And we can really care. I don't, you know, I mean, Tommy's talked about this on the podcast before. Yeah. Like, I don't care if you reduce my incidence of cancer if that gives me cardiovascular disease.
Exactly. Right. So it's what they call a hard endpoint. And they did show that having THC associated was beneficial for mortality.
Mm-hmm.
There's some mechanistic stuff done in mice and rats that do support possibly THC, possibly CBD, other cannabinoids in TBI. So one thing that happens in TBI is that all of a sudden, if you take just this massive whack to the head, you have two main things that happen. There's a whole bunch of stuff that goes awry, but you have a massive energy disruption. So your brain generally runs on glucose for the most part, but it can use ketones. And you get whacked in the skull, the glucose metabolism gets screwed up like almost instantaneously. So now you have a massive energy shortage. And then you can also have a disruption to the blood-brain barrier.
Right.
So it can get disrupted, and now you've got all these compounds flowing into the brain that normally aren't present. You end up with a massive amount of like neuroinflammation at the same time. So CBD and THC, other compounds, may help with that neuroinflammation component of it. And they seem to kind of tone that down a little bit. We do know that they do interact on the what's called the CB1 and CB2 receptors, how much they interact is debatable. And then also there's a very cool mouse study that showed that if you had, I believe it was CBD that was given, or if it was a cannabinoid, a mixed cannabinoid, I can't remember, that if you then whack the mice on the head, the blood-brain barrier stayed more intact.
Okay.
So prophylactically, potentially having that on board before you get hit in the head may reduce your chance of having that blood-brain barrier open up. Again, we won't have a prospective study in humans on that.
Right.
No one's going to volunteer to be like, okay, you get cannabinoids, you don't. Okay, let's mix it. Okay, you get whacked in the skull really hard. Okay, you guys don't. So
yeah. Yeah, I can see that. So did cannabis do anything to rescue energy metabolism? You talked about the problems there with TV.
Maybe. Okay. I'm not as convinced on that, but there is some sort of backdoor mechanisms where long-term it may be beneficial for that.
Okay.
So, I mean, like what I do now, my bias is before I go on a kiteboard trip, I know you kiteboard a lot also.
Yeah, I know it.
Fair amount of fish oil, which I'm normally taking, so 2 to 3 grams per day. Increase my dose of creatine monohydrate to 20 grams per day.
20 grams of creatine?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
And that's based on a mouse study.
Okay.
So mice studies, if you kind of transfer them to humans, were maybe 10 to 20 grams.
Okay.
And in that study, they did take the mice and they did whack some of them on the head with creatine and whack some on the head who didn't have creatine.
Yeah.
And then I will use mixed cannabinoids standardized for CBD. Right now, I'm purely guessing on the dosage. I'm probably around 60 milligrams per day.
Okay. And so how do you define a TBI? So I've been kiteboarding. I know what's involved. And I don't feel like I've ever really, I mean, I don't wear a helmet. I mean, yeah. I've surely, you know, like sometimes you'll do that kind of whiplash thing, you know, where you catch your heel edge and your head goes whack down on the water.
Oh, yeah.
But that's, you know, it's not like I'm seeing stars or anything. You think that's enough of an impact to cause a traumatic brain injury?
It's hard because TBIs probably occur in different intensity.
Hmm.
If you have a massive TBI, you'll definitely know. There's not really a lot of question about
right.
it. A whole bunch of stuff just goes offline, from feeling horrible to light sensitivity. Testosterone can directly drop, mental fog, all sorts. It's not really, did I have one or not? But you could have accumulation of small amounts of trauma, especially if you think like American football players, things of that nature. And then the mechanisms can also be different. And the locations of what actually gets impacted can also be different.
Hmm.
So TBI is a very broad range term.
Okay.
And you can have, there's different mechanisms, from pure kind of the brain is sitting inside the skull and it gets hit. So this kind of direct sort of trauma that way. Or if you have a high speed movement, you can kind of shear some of the neurons apart from each other.
Right.
So there's even different mechanisms within TBI itself, depending upon what was the mechanism of injury too.
It sounds like it's highly applicable to me then, as a kiteboarder and a mountain biker.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's the other thing. I mean, I wouldn't say, unless you count like the really, I do think about this as well, like the very violent jolting. I mean, I've got
jarring. You
know, yeah, I have suspension on my mountain bike and it's very good, but still there's probably more jarring than humans were designed to withstand on a regular basis. And then of course if I leave the trail and go into a tree, then that could easily be a TBI. So maybe CBD would be indicated for people like me then.
I think so. I mean, I look at what is the potential upside versus what is the potential downside.
Yeah, very much.
You know, so if
that.
we don't have a lot of data, and the data right now is very preliminary, the first thing I'm going to look at is what's the potential downside. Right. Do we know that these compounds are generally regarded as safe?
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a fair amount of data showing that they appear to be very safe. Are there issues that could happen? Absolutely. Like, you drink too much water, water can freaking kill you too.
Yeah.
So everything can have
a downside.
It's
very expensive though, right? Like we use that. So we've been using it in our clinic somewhat, I wouldn't say a lot, but somewhat, for gut inflammation.
Sure.
And it's like the most expensive supplement that we have.
Oh,
miles,
it's very expensive.
Yeah.
And that's the, I would say, potential downside. So on the upside with TBI, I think it can be beneficial. Again, we don't have a ton of hard data, but for me personally, I'm like, okay, not much of a negative downside other than cost. Potential upside, probably kind of unbounded right now. We don't really know. It appears to be beneficial. How beneficial? Not really sure. But for me, I'll hedge my bets, especially if I'm going to, like, I was out in Hood River, Oregon for 2 weeks, a couple weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
Kiteboarding every day. If I'm trying to save a little money, maybe I'll just start loading CBD for two-ish weeks before I go, and then just throughout that whole trip. Again, highly theoretical, but I'm condensing that into a period of time where I know I'm probably going to be at a higher risk because I'm trying to, you know, mitigate some of the cost.
Right.
For other things, like for sleep and stuff like that, which we'll probably get into. I mean, I've tested up to 300 milligrams of CBD a day, and you can definitely, like, hear a sound of a Hoover upright on your wallet as it just sucks all the money out of your pockets.
Yeah, so how much were you talking about, like 300 milligrams per day? How much is that going to cost?
Oh, man, I'd have to look, because I don't know. I'd have to double check and run.
Maybe I'll do a sum and put it numbers in the show notes for this.
Yeah, because I was using a 60 milligram concentration, and I was using five of those.
Right.
So I want to say it was in probably the $10 to $30 a day, somewhere in there. That's a guess.
Uh-huh. So it's kind of up there with the ketone ester. You just reminded me about the ketone ester as a potential neuroprotective agent. Have you thought about that for your kiteboarding too?
I carry the HVMN ester in my kiteboarding
kit. These
bloody
health coaches are dripping in money.
I know. The good part is, because I've only used it if I get whacked in the head really hard, I have the same vial. I don't know. Maybe it's not good anymore.
Oh, really? Oh, so you're thinking as a, not as a prophylactic, but as a...
Yeah, I think prophylactically might be helpful, but man, that gets expensive fast at $25 to $35 a pop.
Right.
But my thought being, if something happens and I get to shore, I'm probably going to be fasting at that point, and then I'll take that as soon as I possibly can to try to, because we know some of that disruption occurs within minutes to hours, so like 4 hours, a lot of it kind of peaks.
Okay.
So my thought is, if I can get super high levels of ketones within a short period of time, so I have used the ester and I have tested my ketones, I can easily get over 2 to maybe sometimes 3 with just one of the vials, depending upon, you know, other conditions, that kind of stuff. So my thought is, if I do that, maybe that'll be a bridge to try to mitigate some of that energy crisis.
Right, right, right. Because that can rescue. So Brianna Stubbs talked about the potential to rescue energy metabolism in the brain recently with the ketone ester.
Yeah. So I probably should have another one, because for someone my size, when I talked to her, like, I probably need a dose of two of them, actually. Yeah.
Shit, you got me worried now. Like, I do all this. I'm thinking cyclocross season's coming up. I could easily end up in a TBI as well. Like, maybe I should be thinking. And I didn't even wear a helmet when I was kiteboarding. Like,
I usually wear a helmet now, just because I've taken some, you know, pretty bad crashes and stuff like that. You know, depends on what I'm doing, where I'm going. But I'd say I probably wear a helmet 90% of the time.
Do you use one of those, the strap that connects your board? Like, I think that's freaking... Yeah, I was going to say, those things are freaking lethal.
Yeah, it's... I'll be honest, like probably 4 or 5 years ago, I did, and I never had any issues with it. I used one for surfing, so if it gets pulled too hard, it will snap. But yeah, I don't think having a hard implement potentially coming back at your head is a good idea.
So I realize I should explain this now for the listener. In kiteboarding, some people, so you use a leash, right? The problem in kiteboarding is, if you get separated from your board, you're kind of screwed, because it's really difficult to go upwind to get it, which is inevitably what happens. It can be done, but it takes forever. Sometimes you've seen this, like people are like half an hour, even three quarters of an hour going backwards and forwards, trying to get back upwind just so they can get their board. So the temptation is that you're going to attach yourself to the thing with a leash. But then what happens is, if you get like catapulted away from your board quickly, the tension in the leash builds, and then it fires the thing at the back of you. And I've been hit. I remember the first time I got hit by it, it hit me in my waist harness. It was kind of padded.
Oh, yeah.
And it still nearly snapped me in half. And I thought, my God, if that had hit me in the ribs or something, it...
Or in the head.
Or in the head, it would have been lights out, right?
I would never use a leash without a helmet. I mean, even then, I wouldn't recommend a leash. Good buddy of mine was in the Dominican Republic, and I told him, and I'm like, dude, I said, I should probably just pay you to take a lesson to figure out how to get my board back, you know? And he was super helpful. In Cabarete, it's kind of weirdly wavy and stuff.
Yeah.
And so the hard part was, you wouldn't see your board. Like, you would, because of the waves, it would disappear behind the wave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what I found out, the trick to it was, he taught me, is, okay, as soon as you blow your board off, just automatically start heading upwind. Don't even look for your board.
Right,
don't worry
right.
about it. Count to 16. So I'm going upwind, kind of away from it. Turn around and then count backwards and come back through that area. And at some point, because the board is going to drift a certain way, you'll actually come back to it.
Okay.
The only exceptions are maybe if there's a really, really strong current, things like that. And amazingly enough, I mean, luckily there, I lost my board a bunch of times. I was able to get back to it every time. Even in Hood River recently, a buddy of mine lost his board, wasn't able to get back to it. So I had to practice going to get his board, finding it, and then trying to carry it while you're kiteboarding.
Yeah.
That was way harder than I thought it was. I still think I can't do that.
Like, I really want to help someone that's lost their board, but I can't do it. I can't. Once I'm holding their board, I can't get back up on planing again. So
yeah.
I'm not really, anyway. I'm worse than useless. The person thinks they're going to get their board back, but I'm just sticking around.
Yeah, that's happened too. But yeah, so I think it can be helpful with that. Again, ketones, I think, can be helpful with that too. We know that there's not much of a negative downside.
Right.
And there's probably a fair amount of potential upside with that also. I think having that as a bridge is useful, which that makes you think even in the future, like NFL games, things of that nature. Maybe they have the glucose drink on the side and they have the ketone drink on the side. You know, you get whacked in the skull, no more glucose, maybe only ketones for
right,
you. Or maybe we mix them prophylactically before you go out. Or and again, that's all highly theoretical. There's stuff about are the salts going to be able to get you high enough as a ketone salt. You may need an ester, you know, what type of ester, what type of byproducts, that type of thing.
Talk about sleep. When Tommy first started looking at the data on this, he found this ancient paper that I know you know, and it looked like cannabidiol, right? The CBD, it increased growth hormone and then altered the metabolism of cortisol. So it looked kind of on paper like a stimulant. And so that led to our recommendation that you should probably split this into doses in the early part of the day because there's a chance it could interfere with your sleep. And this was at the like 60 milligram range split into four doses. But, you know, anecdotally, people say that CBD is good for their sleep. And in fact, I think even Tommy is saying that now, that maybe not at the 60 milligram range, but like lower doses than that, micro doses. I'm not exactly sure. I'll have to ask him what he's using. But he's saying that it improves his sleep, which is kind of paradoxical, right?
It can. And there's one other recent study. I know the paper you're talking about. I've got to believe the scanned copy of it is like super, super old.
I'll link to it again in the show notes, but it's ancient.
Yeah. But it appears to be there's a different effect if you take it in the AM versus the PM. So in the AM, it appears to help a little bit with reduction of anxiety, maybe a little bit of focus. Doesn't appear to make you sleepy unless you go up to a massively high dose. In the PM, it appears to increase, paradoxically, sleep. So that may have to do with how it interacts with, you know, other compounds or hormones, which is really trippy to wrap your head around, right? Because you think, like, caffeine, well, shit. I drink caffeine in the morning, I get the same response. I drink caffeine at night, I get the same response, right? But it appears that the response may actually be a little bit different. And that does match a lot of the anecdotal stuff. And I've tried that too, where I can take pretty high doses in the morning. I don't really get sleepy, but I take it in the evening and it does appear to help my sleep a little bit. I don't know. It's still hit or miss.
Right.
Like I've noticed for myself personally, 60 milligrams or more is probably the minimum threshold. But I've had other clients show me their Aura data at, you know, 20 milligrams and they've seen a, you know, an increase in it too. So the research on sleep is all across the board. There was one brand new study just came out in August that actually looked at randomized trials that have been done with it. And they said it appears to show a benefit. However, it's, you know, very limited data, low number of N, some of the trials aren't properly controlled, all that kind of stuff scientists throw in when they're basically like, we don't really know for sure.
And then typically, how would they assess sleep in a study like that?
Well, that's the other question too, right? So what are you looking at? Are you looking at like a full, you know, PSG sleep study? Are you looking at self-report? Are you looking at any other markers? Then you get into the whole argument of, well, if I throw someone in a sleep lab and tell them to sleep, are they really sleeping what they normally would?
Well,
now
then you've
got this other compound.
You've got this other group that doesn't go to the lab, and guess what?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so there is good data to support that the endocannabinoid system is regulating sleep and pain and a bunch of these other things. So a lot of the, because initially I looked at a lot of the claims that are made on CBD now, and my first thought was like, that's all bullshit. There's no way. This is all just crap. And then you look at the endocannabinoid system and you're like, huh, oh, wow. That is like all throughout the body. It does potentially help regulate sleep. It does help potentially pain. It does do all these other things. So if CBD is interacting with that system, which it appears to, although not in a really super clean fashion, then there is at least a physiologic underpinning that it might be beneficial in a lot of these other cases, anxiety, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. The actual hard data on that is debatable. I'd say probably the top three are potentially sleep, head trauma. There's some very interesting research on pain.
Well, that was going to be my next question. What do you think about pain?
I think that there's pretty good data on that. Again, like I went into the talk, now you get into the messy area of, okay, was it a CBD tincture? Was it an isolated CBD?
Right.
Was it with mixed cannabinoids? What was the dose? When was it given? If you're looking at states where, you know, cannabis is legal, now you're looking at, okay, was it in, did you just roll a joint of X amount percent THC to CBD? Did you put it in a vaporizer? Okay, if you vaporize like the actual flower, the compound itself, what temperature did you vaporize it at? Because that will affect the compounds that come out.
Wow.
If you're doing a super low temperature, you'll get more of the other terpene compounds at a much higher percent. You actually won't get a lot of THC or CBD. So the boiling point of CBD and THC are almost identical. They're very, very, very close.
Right.
So you can't differentiate those two by just changing the temperature. Mm-hmm. You would have to change that by actually having the raw material be different. Mm-hmm. So that's the part where it gets really messy when you're trying to look at all the different research studies, is you got to go all the way back and have to look at what was the method. Mm. And then with pain stuff, you look at animal studies. Well, how did they induce pain? How did they report pain? With humans, they just use a VIS, visual analog scale. What type of pain? There's different types of pain. Was it more of a in-hospital clinical study where they're giving a set dose to maybe people who have, you know, neuro pain or something like that, or bone pain or whatever, and then just asking them, how did you feel afterwards? Mm-hmm. You know, which again, for pain is probably a valid marker. But when you look at other studies for that, lots of stuff can modify pain too. Mm-hmm. So I think for pain is probably pretty useful, especially when you start getting into inhaled versions, especially with some THC. I think having some THC and CBD for pain, there's some good data to show that. There's a lot of anecdotal reports that, yeah, that's probably pretty good. And if you're using an edible version of a THC, that's actually a completely different compound in the liver. Mm. So it gets converted to 11-hydroxy-THC, which for all practical purposes is a completely different drug.
Wow.
And there's some big anecdotal reports, especially in people who come back from the military who have lost limbs, that, you know, phantom limb pain. You know, I talked to a lot of people in Colorado, ex-special forces people come back. Off the record, they will report they use pretty high levels of edibles. Mm-hmm. And they said that for a lot of them that I talked to, that was the only thing that touched their phantom limb pain.
So what, they try different methods of taking the drug?
A lot of them have tried just about everything. Because okay. If you've got a missing leg, but you've got this blinding pain, like you still have a leg.
Right.
I would probably try just about anything.
Yeah.
You know, and people are frankly scared away from opiates, things of that nature, for good reason. So different drugs appear to affect different, maybe even types of pain.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. But so what would you recommend? I guess it just depends on the application then. Like, I mean, I don't want to be smoking stuff or vaping things, like putting shit into my lungs that's not supposed to be there. That sounds like just a terrible idea in general. So what would you, and then if edibles are just a totally, you end up with a completely different thing, then
That's the hard part, right? Because if you're using an edible, different pathway, right? So first pass phase in the liver will change the drug. But it's different than if you use like a vapor or an inhalation. Mm. My bias, if you find that you're in a state where it's legal and you're like, I find that, you know, edibles didn't really do much of anything for it, I would look at a vape that is only the actual flower itself. Mm-hmm. It's coming out of Boulder called Grasshopper. They have a vape where you can basically put in just the flower material itself and you can adjust the temperature. So at least that way you know there's no other compounds that you're ingesting.
Oh, wow. The level of sophistication is amazing.
Oh, it's crazy. And it looks like a pen. I have one. But it actually looks like a pen. Like, I could set it out on this table and most people would probably not even think anything about it.
Wow.
If you get into the oils, you have to be very careful and ask the manufacturer, what else did you put in here? Can you guarantee what is the purity? That kind of stuff. And then price point is a good guide. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if you're maybe just putting a bunch of THC and a bunch of oil, maybe throwing some other stuff there. You know, you want to look to see what you have, or at least if it's just the vaping of the actual flower material itself. I know that there wasn't anything extraneous that's being entered into that equation.
Okay. Well, so you don't think the vaping is inherently harmful then? You don't?
Oh, it's highly debatable. So there's okay. only a couple studies that have looked at that. It doesn't appear to be nearly as bad as, you know, cigarette smoking, things of that All nature. Right. If you look at long-term outcomes, even with just, you know, joints or just kind of rolled cannabis in terms of cancer, rates don't appear to be, from what I've seen, to be really high.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't say that it's a guarantee that you're not. I mean, anytime you're burning something and inhaling it into your lungs, there's probably going to be some type of reaction.
Right.
But it doesn't appear to be nearly as bad as, you know, cigarettes and things of that nature.
You say not as bad, but is it just not as well studied?
Well, that's the thing. The data we have now would say that it doesn't appear to be nearly as bad. But again, you know, it's the thing of, well, how much data do you want to see and need to see?
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now, there's just not a ton of data. The data right. we have shows that it doesn't appear to be super bad, but it's like the same thing you have with scientists. You're like, okay, all we've got 12 studies that show that this is a good thing. Like if you look at early research into creatine, first 5 studies, ooh, really positive. You could say, that's just 5 studies. That doesn't mean anything. Okay, 12 studies, 11 of the 12 are positive. I don't know. That's just not really quite enough data for me, right?
There's, right.
What do you need to reach a consensus is now we have, you know, almost 500 peer-reviewed studies on creatine. Most of them all show it's positive. Yeah, now we can probably say there's a very good consensus that it's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's taken decades and millions of dollars, and it's by far the most studied supplement ever.
Mm-hmm.
And then who's going to pay for the studies? Who's going to do the study?
Yeah, of course.
It was a long-term study. Well, that was something you mentioned. How long are you going to look at it?
Yeah, that, I mean, that was something you mentioned in your talk is that this is now big business, right? It's not like we're not talking about impoverished companies making, you know, white labeling the same creatine that everybody uses.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, cannabis is the CBD market is estimated just to be around, last estimate I saw was $23 billion within a few years. Like the fastest growing area is beverages.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see CBD is in like almost every beverage now. In the talk I said, as in Hood River, you can get CBD added to your coffee for $2.
Wow. And there's, do you think there's actually any CBD in there? Like, do I need to see, like up until now, I was like, if I don't see the certificate of analysis, I'm not interested. Like if you can't show me how much of the compounds is
yeah.
in it, I don't
And that's the hard
out.
Part, right? You want to know how much of the compound is actually in there. A lot of it is just really small doses, 2-5 milligrams, which probably right. not going to do much of anything.
Right.
There is another company that has 25 milligrams in theirs. You know, again, for how much it costs right now, I look a lot at like price point.
Uh-huh.
And if you know anything about the beverage market in general, yeah, they want to get the highest price point they can, but at some point, you're not going to spend $10 for an energy drink, right? Uh-huh. There's a point where lowering the price, you're probably going to make up for it in volume.
Yeah.
So if you add something that's expensive, so CBD right now as an ingredient is very expensive. Ooh, where's that happy medium where people are willing to pay for it? You can get your money back. It's a legit amount in there, make money on it. And you know, there's going to be some people who are just going to put it on the label and probably not put anything in there potentially.
Yeah.
Right. And until it's been, you know, tested and all that kind of stuff. Yes, it's still regulated by the FDA. Yes, you'd be in violation of the FDA because you're violating the ingredients you have on the container. So it is regulated. The hard part is it's not really enforced.
Right.
Right. Right. So who's going to do that? So now there's tons of CBD companies. As of this recording, the FDA hasn't really cracked down on too many of them yet. I have a feeling that that's probably coming.
Oh, really?
You know, the rumors I've heard, which again is just completely rumor at this point and hearsay, they may go after a couple of the top manufacturers to try to, you know, set a precedent for the industry. Probably because if you have a limited manpower, that kind of makes the most sense. Not that I agree with it. Trying to chase down all these other small fly-by-night companies, that's a lot of time, a lot of money. And the reality is the FDA just doesn't have that much money put into
right.
enforcement
right.
for supplements. They just don't.
Yeah.
So.
What about people that get drug tested? Should they be worried about it, either as a you know, for performance enhancing drugs in sport, or maybe you do a job where you get drug tested too. You know, if I buy some isolated CBD oil online, should I be worried about the THC concentration that may get me busted at work or in a bike race, say?
I would say because there is research to show that THC amount in some of the things that were tested was much higher than what was stated on the label.
Okay. So, could that vary from batch to batch as well? So the certificate of analysis, you know, that they published on the website, we did this, like, you know, it costs a lot of money to do that stuff. They're not going to run it every batch.
Yeah, I would ask them that. Like, how often do you run this, right? Yeah. So are you taking certain samples? Do you do it per batch? What percentage do you test down to?
Right.
Right. Because by virtue of dealing with those compounds, there is going to be some THC in there.
Right.
Now, that may be a 1/1,000,000,000th amount of whatever.
Right. But there must be a cutoff for the drug test. It's not like they're going to bust you if they find, you know, one molecule of the...
And that's the thing, right? So there's all sorts of different drug tests. Are they just using a simple urine test? Are they using a blood test? What is their threshold? What are they cutting off to?
Hmm.
Right. I mean, even go back in time to the, you know, Olympics of, you know, I was just, you know, hanging out in a room where people were smoking. You know, that potentially, depending on what level you're looking down to, that
do you,
could
don't,
be,
do you buy that? I'm laughing. Do you buy that as a?
I would say it's possible. I mean, depending on what level you're looking to.
Uh-huh.
So for people looking at it, I would say figure out what your testing is. You know, call and ask them and say, hey, are you testing down to a very low level? Because the reality is you're dealing with people who live in states where it's legal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we're in California and we're hanging out with some people and they're doing something, I walk by, there's not a lot of good data to show what your risk is. From what I've heard, most companies aren't testing down to a very, very super low level. One, because the testing is more expensive. But for CBD, because THC is legal in the product up to 0.3%, and in theory, if you have a drug test that's looking at a very low level, that could be enough to have an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there are companies who do make a CBD-only isolate. I know Charlotte's Web does make one. Again, I would probably only go with like a very top manufacturer, and I would call them to ask them what is their testing procedure, and then what is the amount that they will test down to.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, there's some very, very infinitesimal small amount there. What is the analytical method and what is that testing limit? Mm-hmm. And that CBD isolated oil will be much more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it's additional processing. And also for the company, it's an additional risk because you are stating that, hey, we're putting our name on this. We are saying that this has a very low, you know, 0% THC. They don't want someone to come back, you know, after them and say, okay, we tested positive and get into that whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Assuming you're a legit company trying to do it by legit reasons.
Okay. So we talked about traumatic brain injury. We talked about sleep. We talked about pain. Is there a potential ergogenic effect? Because it is a banned substance, right? Like I shouldn't
Most places. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to check with what the ruling is because it does change.
Right.
I can't say what organizations, but I know very high-level organizations that make lots of money where humans run into each other are extremely interested in something that would be legal that may be a neuroprotective effect.
Okay.
And there have been various lobbies stating that maybe allowing a small amount of THC to lighten up the restrictions, that may actually be beneficial potentially for some of the players.
Right.
I believe Robert Oberst was saying that World's Strongest Man, they do not test for marijuana anymore, I believe.
Okay.
Partially because a lot of the people doing that were using it for pain relief. And they said, we'd much rather use this than take a bunch of opiates.
Right.
But most sporting organizations right now, it's still considered a banned substance.
Okay. So do you think this is going to help me win bike races?
Data on that is not super good. A lot of it's super old too.
Yeah.
You know, so data and performance, especially aerobic performance, it's usually the anecdotal thing you'll hear people say, oh, it was just, you know, so much easier. Everything felt better. And then I always ask them for what was your hard performance data? It may have felt better because you're a little spacey and weren't paying attention, but did you actually perform better? Most of the data that I've pulled so far shows not a huge aerobic benefit that we've seen. Again, at a certain dose, work capacity went down. One of the studies had a thing that said a certain percentage of people were not able to complete the work at all, which kind of makes sense, right? If you think about it, you do a little bit too much, you're like, duh, I ain't getting on that bike.
Yeah. Yeah, anecdotally, in Santa Cruz, I know lots of people that use it in the middle of bike rides, and it seems unthinkable to me, but maybe I just don't understand the effects.
I've had people who do a lot of, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, things of that nature, report that it helps quite a bit. It's probably a personal thing. Again, there's just not a ton of data on that because, again, most of it's probably funding. Who's going to pay for it?
Right.
And then you get into the whole thing of, like, what was the delivery method? What was the amount? You can even get into genetic stuff. Some people will maybe faster metabolisms of the different compounds. Some people get a little paranoid. Also, how often do people use it? If you're more accustomed to using it, maybe do you have a different motor tolerance learning effect you've got learning going on with these compounds present? Maybe you need to do it under that condition,
pair
too.
Conditioning.
Right. There's supposedly some old Russian research that showed giving people stimulants and then testing them. And I don't remember what the stimulant was. Maybe it was Adderall or something similar. And basically what the rumor was, what they found was, if you didn't study under the stimulant, your testing didn't do better.
Right.
So just giving someone a stimulant before a test, testing got worse. But if you paired the condition, right, I study under a stimulant and I take the test under the stimulant, then their scores are actually a little bit higher.
Okay.
And that would kind of make sense with how you think about motor learning, what you think about what's going on there, different things like that too, which I've wondered about that in some of the caffeine studies also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you train with caffeine and then does that transfer and that type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
So performance-wise, very mixed. Most of the data would say probably not a huge performance boost that we have seen so far.
Okay. Well, let's tell people what we told them, see if I can summarize for you. So you talked about TBI and you think there's something there. And in fact, you are using it. You talked about sleep and you think there's something there and people are getting benefit. You talked about pain. There's something there and people are getting benefit. But as an ergogenic aid, probably not.
Probably not. And I'd say the ergogenic aid probably also really, really depends on what are you doing, right? So pool is even considered a sport, right? Which would be very different than a mountain bike race or a kiteboard race or a powerlifting event.
Right.
And so the amount of variables you're dealing with, and you talk about just sport in general,
it's not specific
enough
to, exactly. Yeah.
And even now we're arguing still how many years later about the effect of freaking carbohydrates.
Yeah.
Right. And how many studies have we looked at on carbohydrates for hundreds of years?
Yeah.
You know, the odds that we're going to have a simple answer on it in the next 2, 5, 10 years is very unlikely.
Uh-huh. Well, this has been very helpful. Thank you very much, Mike. I will link to your Ancestral Health Symposium talk in the show notes for this episode that you can find over at nourishmentthrive.com/podcast. Tell me, do you have space in your coaching practice? It's primarily strength athletes that you work with. Is that correct?
Yeah, primarily strength athletes, obstacle course racers, some CrossFit people, some people just looking to, you know, feel better, move better, better health, things of that nature. So, yeah, I do have a few spots open. May not as the time
by the time I get this out,
yeah. So if you want info, just go to www.miketnelson.com. At the top, there's usually a way to get on the newsletter. Most information goes out over the newsletter. And then I also have a certification, which is just flexdiet.com, FLEXDIET.com. And that's just talking about everything on the recovery side from nutrition, sleep, different impacts of that. Mm. Mostly designed for more fitness trainers, enthusiasts, or people who run a gym that are trying to get more of the nutrition practice to go with their gym.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I very much appreciate
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.